Welcome to the Last Round MMA.
The guy's never beaten me. In order to be the champion, you have to beat the champion.
A podcast for the MMA fan.
Imagine that. Look at everybody up here. They're all dressed like me. They're all trying to talk like me. They're all trying to be me.
Bringing you in-depth interviews and more from across the MMA world.
This is like pride. You know, everybody's here. I feel great. And, you know, I can't wait. Saturday night, I'm going to crush this guy hype.
Are you ready? Let's start the show.
Welcome to The Last Round MMA, and today's special guest is Kyle Sarafine, the co-founder and publisher at Hamilcar Publications and Hannibal Boxing Media. Thanks for joining me, Kyle.
Thanks, Shep. Appreciate it, man. Good to be back, sort of. Obviously, it was with you and Danny last year. Enjoyed it.
So no better place to start than at the beginning. So Kyle, where did you grow up and what are your earliest memories of boxing?
Okay. Grew up in a little seaside town in Massachusetts. Currently live in Gloucester, Massachusetts, which is just about 30 miles north of Boston. I grew up in a town called Rockport, which is right next door. It's sort of about the quaintest New England seaside town that you could imagine. I actually started the business 5 years ago or so with a high school friend, Andy Comack, who grew up in Rockport with me, as a matter of fact. We have an author there too, interestingly, Don Stradley, who's written 5 books for Hamilcar, notably The War, and then like 3 of the noir Hamilcar noir books, as well as a true crime book, which I'm sort of, we're getting into straight true crime. He wrote a book called Boston Tabloid, which came out in November, which has done pretty well. So it's sort of interesting to have an author who grew up in my hometown, which is right next door. So I still live here. It's sort of like a place where most people that I grew up with, that people don't really move away. You know, like some places, you know, everyone leaves to go to cities, but Boston's so close. The train, the commuter rail to Boston is about a 4-minute walk from my house, and that's basically, you know, I'm sort of a product of Boston publishing houses as well. Chicken or the egg, you know, I got into publishing maybe because it was here, or, you know, who knows, but, you know, some people have to sort of move away to, you know, from, you know, people in the Midwest who work in, you know, Boston publishing. I never really had to move. So Publishers Weekly actually profiled several Boston publishers, including us. And it was sort of, the theme of the piece was, you know, homegrown publishing people, you know, people who worked for, I did like the grand tour of publishers around here, you know, Houghton Mifflin, Quarto, science publisher called Elsevier. You know, I was really a product of my environment in that respect. So it's where I'm from and definitely how I got into the business. You know, they're New York, sort of the center of the universe in terms of publishing, book publishing, but Boston's really not too far behind, you know, and it's a lot of the bigger ones, but there are like so many publishers around here. Like, you know, you'd be surprised, you know.
Who were your favorite fighters growing up, Kyle?
Hagler first, Ali. I'd throw Hector Camacho in there too. You know, we did Macho Time, and you know, I'm 52. I really grew up in the 80s, right? Like, born in 71, so 1980 to 1990, I was 9 to 19, which sort of, you know, I think like a lot of young men, boys, whatever, like really get into sports during that decade. And I watched the matinees on the networks over here, you know, much different. Think like Top Rank shows on ESPN, but during the day, and no ESPN Plus. That's what it was, you know, all three ABC, NBC, CBS had fights all the time, you know. So I was sports obsessed. I played soccer, basketball, tennis, played a little college soccer. You know, I was like a sports obsessed kid. And I was sort of omnivorous, like when it came to sports, like I watched everything, you know, ABC, Wide World of Sports, like people, you know, my age or older, a little bit younger, maybe, like they had on everything, like car racing, you know, boxing, gymnastics, bike race, you know, everything. But I couldn't get enough of it, you know, if there was a competition, I watched it all. But like a function of that was, or outgrowth of that was watching all the fights in the 80s. So I'm really kind of steeped in that nostalgia. And I think anyone my age who's a boxing fan, you know, that stuff really resonates. You know, Boom Boom Mancini, Camacho, Larry Holmes, you know, all those, Arguello, Aaron Pryor, you know, all those guys were on TV often in the afternoon. It was great. Then you had like Tim Ryan and Gil Clancy, like these iconic announcing teams as well. You know, like it occasionally I'll pull up one of those fights, like a Camacho fight, especially doing the book. Like I kind of do my own research in addition to the author, and you know, hearing like Gil Clancy and Tim Ryan call a fight, like it throws me back, man. You know, I feel like I'm like 13 again. On a Saturday, you know, eating Cheerios, watching all those fights, you know, it's very, very nostalgic.
What's the oldest fight that you can remember watching? What's the earliest fight?
Oh man, that's a good question. I think some Larry Holmes fights. Larry Holmes, Tex Cobb. I think I watched that. You know, it's hard to identify a specific fight, but it was one of the Boom Boom Mancini. I watched the Duck Koo Kim fight. I think that was 82. You know, I was a kid. You know, I think it's different. It's different these days with, you know, internet, video games, and all that stuff. Like kids who were into sports who are my age, that was our entertainment. You know what I mean? We weren't looking at websites and we weren't playing, you know. I was never really interested in video games. Some kids had Atari, but I had no interest in that. I liked playing sports and watching sports.
Were you a big reader or writer as a child? And did you think that publishing would be something in your future?
Yeah, that's a really good question, man. Like Well, the interesting thing was, I always scored off the charts in the language testing, reading and writing. That the, you know, fifth grade, I would be whatever percentile, 99 or 100. And then, like up until fifth grade, I was an excellent student. But then they started assigning homework, and I kind of had no use for homework. So I was playing sports all the time, and I, you know, went to school. And then you have practice for 2 hours and you come home and eat. And then, you know, you're assigned all this homework and I didn't like it, you know? So I sort of did it in a cursory way often, you know? But here's the thing. And I did okay. I was, you know, it's like a above average student, you know what I mean? But like, I was really the sports obsession kind of, you know, sort of, you know, pulled me away from academics a little bit. But the interesting thing, and like, again, speaking of like that time in the 80s and people like me who were, you know, my authors were definitely like this, right? Like, you know, my sort of accidental education was reading every word of Sports Illustrated for 10 years, you know? And you even have guys like, you know, Mark Cram, trying to think of, you know, Frank DeFord, you know, some of the names are escaping me, but the iconic Sports Illustrated, William Knack, like those guys were like really exceptional writers. Like the level of prose in Sports Illustrated at that time was very high. And looking back, that was my, and I was, you know, fortunately, I was so interested and obsessed with sports that I just read SI and a lot of other sports magazines obsessively. And I think the quality of the prose back then was so good that it really helped me as a reader. Plus I was reading biographies, sports biographies at a young age too. So that was really my education. I didn't get into books until I was 20 years old. I played a couple of years of college soccer. I kind of partied in college and kind of did enough to get into a decent state school in the mountains of New Hampshire. And the level of soccer there was really high and I was into it. But then I wasn't getting that much playing time. The team, you know, there's some guys who even played like Division II pro after that, like in the UK, you know what I mean? I think the team was like four in the country in Division III, which soccer, there's not a huge difference sometimes between one and three over here in the case of some schools. But anyway, long story short, like, you know, I just kind of, I saw the writing on the wall and books became my sports when I was 20. You know, I've always been sort of internally competitive and, you know, that's all of a sudden my focus shifted to books and writing and language. And that's been my main passion and obsession ever since.
And what was the first step into publishing once you finished college?
Yeah, it's interesting. I it's funny. I got out of school in like 94, and sort of like a weird time. Like the colleges that I went to, you know, at that time, like I don't even know if Word was, you know, it was like Word Perfect, and like the colleges that I went to, like they didn't really teach like computer skills, you know. And I think people maybe 5 years older than me like learned all that stuff. So I got out of school, and it was like I was at a sort of technological loss in terms of applying for jobs and all that, you know. So I kind of struggled to get a job. I wanted to get a job in publishing. You know, I got out of school when I was 23. I did an internship at a very prestigious boutique publisher called Shambhala Publications, which they're sort of like the foremost publisher of Eastern culture in the West, in English, like Buddhism, and they have like the definitive translation of Art of War, like unbelievable design standards, and which I think I was honestly like before and after influenced by that house, you know, like Hamilcar's design standards are extremely high and like very old school in terms of book design. Not a lot of publishers now observe that sort of tradition, if you will. And Shambhala was like definitely like that. So I left Shambhala, but then I still couldn't get a full-time job. I did a publishing program at Emerson College. I was doing, interestingly, I was an excavation laborer for 2 years, digging holes and busting rock. Obviously my hometown's called Rockport, right? It's like there's, this place where I live, Cape Ann, is like filled with granite. The granite industry was huge here in like the late 19th, early 20th century. So you have to put water lines like 6 feet in the ground. And I was literally it was like being on a chain gang, but I wasn't in jail. So it's sort of interesting experience. You know, it was like half the crew had like gone to college. It was my best friend's or one of my best friend's father's company. You know what I mean? So it wasn't like that. It was, you know, it was a bunch of cool guys. Like one guy used to like read Tolstoy at lunch. You know what I mean? So it wasn't, you know, it was a pretty cool group of guys. But, you know, I went from digging holes and breaking rocks to working for a publisher called Academic Press when I was 88, which was like a weird transition, you know, to go from you know, one completely different world to another. So yeah, I got into the business when I was 28. And
you think that working that chain gang, as you say, do you think that gave you the kick up the butt you needed to focus on following your dream into publishing, maybe?
Definitely, man. Without question, that's a good question. Because, you know, as cool as the crew was, like, you know, the great thing about publishing, and I think that, you know, any sort of work environment is going to be difficult, you know, with different personalities and politics, office stuff. But publishing's like a very nice and, you know, typically like a very nice, I had great experiences working in publishing houses, like, you know, and the construction world, like, was definitely, you know, as cool as that crew was, like, you know, it's kind of a hard world a little bit, you know what I mean? Especially at that time, right? Like 1990s, you know, there's still like a lot of old school guys that sort of yell at you when you're in the hole. You know, like, I don't know, like, you know, what are you doing? You know? So yes, the short answer is yes, you know. Plus, you can't do that stuff forever, man. Like, my arms used to fall asleep at night, you know what I mean? We're talking jackhammers, hydraulic drills, bullpoint, jackhammer, breaking up rock. Like, it was crazy, but I was glad that I did it, you know what I mean? It was a good experience, you know. I guess I earned my hard labor stripes, you know. So, but yeah, definitely, like, compelled me to get out, you know.
So how did we get from there to the beginning of Hamilcar Publications?
That's interesting. So I worked for Academic Press, and then I worked for Houghton Mifflin at the time. Now they're Houghton Mifflin Harcourt, and the college textbook division. And then went to Elsevier, a science publisher, did, you know, basically STM, scientific, technical, medical publishing. You know, point being, I worked on all kinds of different books. And then I did like exercise books and cookbooks. I even worked on sex books, like Kama Sutra, you know, books that are in Barnes and Noble, not like X-rated, you know what I mean? And then I went from working on those books and lifestyle books to Curious George. I worked at Pearson. Like, I really did maybe toured more of the publishing houses than some folks. You know, maybe some folks have worked at two, but I worked, you know, six different places, five or six. But the best experience that led me to Hamilcar, I think, in part, was this. I worked for 4 years at a science publisher, Elsevier, which is like one of the biggest ones, Dutch company. And the job that I had at that time was a project manager, and it involved handling book projects for manuscript-bound book, which is basically, you know, author submits the manuscript, the acquiring editor sends me the manuscript, you take it through copy editing, typesetting, proofreading, indexing, right through to printed books, cover design, you're kind of managing that, the interior design. So those jobs, I don't know if those jobs even exist anymore, the manuscript-bound book jobs. And it was probably produced over 100 books, to the point where producing a book was like riding a bike, you know what I mean? And I produce our books, which is from end to end, everything, and I art direct and all that. So, you know, I have a copy editor, a proofreader. I the typesetter that I use is one of the ones that I used 20 years ago at Elsevier, and they're based out of Hong Kong, and they're fantastic. So I really made my bones doing that job, and that led me to this place, which, you know, if you can handle, if you can do everything end to end, it makes you much more self-sufficient as a publisher. And I think that that's really helped with the business. And then I went to business school right after for a couple of years. I wasn't working. And then I started Hamilcar when I was 45 with my friend Andy.
So where did the idea come from, Kyle? Or is it something that you just had a burning ambition to do from a young age?
You know, what's interesting is around the time that I was 35, and that was maybe 2006. It's interesting. Like, Amazon sort of emerged at that time. It emerged as sort of like my main source of discovering books and purchasing books and reading books. And, you know, I think like a lot of people, a lot of book people and publishers and authors, you know, I'm sort of like a rabbit hole person, you know, like a good, an obsessive in the best sense of the word. And you know, I just started reading everything that I could get my hands on in terms of like business and self-development and psychology. And everything sort of pointed to the fact that I was like a nine to five slave, you know? So, you know, I just wanted, I knew it at 35, and I've been working for companies at 7 years. So I always want, you know, from that point on, it was just how to liberate myself from a 9 to 5, you know? And I had different business ideas. Right around 40, I started. I've had various obsessions in my life, and like books are the main one, which persists, right? Sports, of course, but like boxing as a fan, jazz in my 30s, totally immersed in that for like 10 years, hip hop. But then around 40, like business, you know, became, you know, I worked across the street from the Borders books at when I worked at Houghton Mifflin Harcourt, and I'd haunt the business book section. And, you know, it was like two things, realizing that, you know, I think it's, trying to remember, it's Carnegie or, you know, one of those sort of titans of industry said, you know, always be an owner, never a minion. You know, and I think I read that in one of those books. I was like, man, like, you know, so it was like that realization and then kind of going to business school. And I had one of the ideas that I had was to do boxing books when I was about 40 years old, 41, and it took 4 years for it to come together.
Just take us down that path, that journey from sitting down with Andy, I assume, and probably scratching it out on a piece of paper to what it is now.
It's interesting. It's like, you know, it's been five years, officially six. The book publishing is five. It seems like 10 or 15 years. It's interesting. I think part of that is just like learning. I've learned so much, you know. The interesting thing is that the Andy sent me a text, you know, after business school. I had sort of like this day job that I was doing. He sent me a text. You know, he was in a, he had an MBA as well, and like, you know, we were friends and we're like kind of thinking about business ideas. And he wanted to like maybe purchase a website, and it had to do with boxing. It's like a boxing directory. And that's actually how it started, interestingly. And then it turned to journalism with Hannibal. And we're like, oh, well, you know, maybe we, you know, monetize a boxing journalism site. And then I wrote about 10 pieces and then sort of got rolling. And it's like, you know, at a certain point, this is like between June and December. And then right around, published the first piece on Hannibal, like just after Thanksgiving. Interestingly, it was a Bundini Brown piece that I wrote, which ended up turning into the Bundini book, interestingly, or like serving as the framework for that. But it evolved from like a directory website with like Google Ads running on it, to like a journalism, boxing journalism site, boxing directory to boxing journalism to boxing book publisher, you know? And then it sort of evolved from, okay, boxing books, and we acquired the rights to three books, Off the Ropes, Jacob's Beach, Dark Trade. And then we signed the Camacho book, the Bondini Brown book. You know, we started signing authors and you know, I've told people, like, we didn't know anything, but I think the interesting thing is that, you know, because we got distribution, that was like, we're talking like, we started 2018, I believe. And then that was 2019, just in terms of doing those deals and coming out with Off the Ropes, Jacob's Beach, Dark Trade in order. And then, you know, we were kind of off to the races at that point, you know.
Where did the name come from?
The name, interestingly, we had the name Hannibal first, and that's named after Hannibal Barca, you know, the great commander, fought the Romans, you know, everyone knows about the elephants in the Alps and the Battle of Cannae, which is a pretty unbelievable moment, sort of history, military history. I'm half Lebanese. My father talked, you know, my father's Lebanese, and he talked about Hannibal all the time. My grandfather had talked about Hannibal because, you know, he was Carthaginian. Carthage was a Phoenician colony. Phoenicia, sort of modern day Lebanon, is Phoenicia. So it kind of came from that. I also had some cigar art. It was like a defunct cigar brand called Hannibal. And I had a ton of business ideas before this, and I was thinking about maybe reviving this, you know, cigar brand, and that's where the art came from. And we were really bootstrapping at the beginning too, so. So Hannibal Barca, his father was a commander named Hamilcar Barca. So it's sort of like the family tree, you know? And I think it sort of, I don't know, it's the father and the, you know, book publishing imprint. There's a certain gravitas with it. And I thought it was sort of appropriate that it was the father. And I thought it, you know, I like the sound of it. Also, I don't think we would have done like the, you know, I think enough people know Hannibal Barca, the commander, but having the book imprint be Hannibal, like I'd be, you know, actually selling products. I wouldn't want it to be confused with Hannibal Lecter, which, you know, a lot of people know Hannibal Barca, but a lot of people don't. So it sort of, if you will, kind of swerves that whole headache of people thinking that we named the business after a fictional serial killer, you know?
But Kyle, what did friends and family say when you were getting into book publishing? Because the amount of times we hear boxing's dying, and I'm sure people are saying, you know, the books are dying and everything's going to Kindle and online.
Yeah, that, you know, it's funny too, man, because, you know, I was, remember, you know, 2008, 2009, 2010, everyone thought ebooks were going to take over. And I'm halfway through or three quarters of the way through of this book, this doorstop of a book that's fantastic. It's called Book Wars. And it's like, it's a second book by this author, Thompson, who chronicles like the trade book publishing industry. And it's fascinating to read because I sort of lived through that. And, you know, when everyone thought eBooks was going to take over. And what happened was that, you know, the historically it's called, you know, the Codex, the printed and bound book. it's a durable technology in terms of people wanting to sort of reap using it, and you know, and it's durable, like you could throw it off a house, which I think is sort of, you know, made it durable as opposed to e-readers and things like that. And you know, it's fascinating in terms of how, to me, and I think a lot of people, like the motion picture industry and music, like totally got disrupted by digital technology. But with books, it did not happen, and it started to. And this is what I sort of, you know, I sort of knew it observationally, but like in reading this book, like it actually gave some data. And it was like, you know, the Kindle, when did the Kindle emerge? Like 2008, 2009. And then maybe like a couple years later, like the market share of like ebooks was like 30%, like 40%, like 45%, you know? But then the weird thing was it started to trend down. It started to trend down to like 80-20 in favor of printed books. And I think now, you know, I'm exclusive with Amazon now, but for a time with my distributor, I could see the breakdown, you know, print sales versus ebook sales, unit sales. And it was like, it was 90-10 the whole time, maybe 88-12, you know, ebooks were like 8-12% of our business. You know what I mean? And that, you know, and that's generally true. However, certain categories defy that. And I've learned that with our book, Boston Tabloid. It's doing better on the, you know, because I'm exclusive with Amazon, so I sell ebooks through them. And my books are also available on Kindle Unlimited. You know, it's sort of like Spotify for books. You pay $10 and you can read. And I get paid like musicians or get musicians get paid for it's like half a penny a page. You know what I mean? And the true crime, you know, like right now, for example, like Boston Tabloid, I think has like 100,000 page reads already this month. And the next closest book is The War, which is 4,000. So it does depend on the category, you know what I mean? And also like romance and stuff like that. So there is a little bit of nuance there. Like it's, but generally speaking, print books have prevailed.
And how did you decide on the first book that you guys wanted to publish? Because obviously you only get one first impression. So obviously you want to make a splash.
Yeah. You know, yeah, it was like, We did a deal for Off the Ropes, you know, and it was mainly just to get going, and you know, we acquired the rights to Off the Ropes, Jacob's Beach and Dark Trade, and you know, that was an easy way to get three books out in a hurry. You know, Ron Lyle always intrigued me, sort of like a Hurricane Carter book. And you know what's interesting is that one has performed pretty well. You know, I think it has like 120 or 30 reviews on Amazon, which, you know, it's selling steadily. You know, some people one guy, like a friend of one of my authors, we went out to dinner in Boston, and he said, yeah, like the one book that sort of doesn't really fit the list is Off the Ropes. You know, in so many words, I just said, look, man, you know, we were just looking to get rolling. I thought Ron Lyle was cool, and that was pretty much it. You know what I mean? It was sort of like, you know, like a pragmatic thing, if anything. You know what I mean? The Jacob's Beach mixed boxing and the mob. Which, and one thing too, like, which gave me confidence early on was, like our covers, like our cover designer, I think is one of the best ones in the business. And like very early on, he and I like realized how simpatico we were. And while I was in publishing, I also studied. I was like sort of like a student of publishing, which included being a student of book design. And even thought I wanted to be a book designer. So I always had like a very clear sensibility and sort of taste and like a vision in terms of what books should like look like. And that a lot of that's like sort of taking care, putting some real effort and creativity into it, you know, and sort of borrowing sort of like old school stuff, you know, like a lot of our, all of our books now have like these title page spreads and we do images in the interior. Like I sort of try to make them like sort of like quasi art books on some level, you know what I mean? They aren't, you know, I don't want to pay for color printing or coated paper, but you know, within the, you know, the black and white or black on, you know, black ink on cream paper. Like I try to get as artful as I can. And my designer is, his name is Brad Knorr, who's sort of brilliant. He's an illustrator as well. And the point is that I'll make is like reissuing books. I was confident in doing it because I knew that the first the covers kicked ass, you know? I just that was a real source of confidence from the beginning, and I could also see that editorially, and I've definitely obviously grown in 5 years, but as I wasn't an editor in house, so I kind of had to learn on the job a little bit. You know what I mean? I think I had the talent or whatever. I think it was there. You know what I mean, to be developed, but. Like I what I knew was that no one in publishing really knew knew anything about boxing at all. So that was sort of like an advantage, you know. I was literarily inclined. I had, you know, editorial skills from working with especially that job at Elsevier. I hired copy editors for 4 years, so I kind of, you know, I did have the root, you know, sort of like the, you know, the fundamentals down. But I did know the advantage was that no one knew anything about boxing. That came to like picking subjects, picking writers, all that stuff. You know, I think that's how we've kind of set ourselves apart at, you know, 20 books. And like, I think hardcore boxing book fans kind of, they love Hamilcar because, you know, I said this like in an interview before, like I'm a big hip hop person. Like I almost see us as like, we're like the Wu-Tang Clan of like book publishers, like keeping it real. You know what I mean? I remember like Raekwon in one of the outtakes of those songs, you know, on the first Wu-Tang record, he's like, you know, we're making music that I've wanted to hear, you know, which is real stuff, you know. And I feel like we're doing books that are real, and that's, you know, that involves, you know, that has to do with doing a book like The War, you know what I mean? You think the Big Five, you know, Penguin Random House, they'd never do a book on the Hagler Hearns fight, I don't think, or any other publisher for that matter, you know what I mean? Like, because they just like don't know, you know. So that really provided the foundation. And you know, I think Thomas Hauser said in like the last print issue of The Ring that which was really cool, like to see that coming from him, like you know, Hamilcar has contributed significantly to the literary tradition in boxing. And that, you know, for me, like, and I've also like compared like what I'm doing with Hamilcar to like a fighter. You know what I mean? I'm more concerned about legacy than I am money. you know, and money's like very important, you know what I mean? And I'm getting into, you know, mainstream categories like true crime, and did a book about the Doors, and I'm doing, Carlos Acevedo is actually writing a book about the film, The Exorcist, the making of it, and following up with a true crime book from him. Like, but you know, the 20 or so books that I did in boxing, I think it, you know, it served a purpose to build a reputation. And you know, I think that it did sort of contribute to the literary tradition of boxing, which like I'm proud of. And you know, I feel like, you know, the most important thing for me is to publish with integrity and make money at the same time. And I think that can be done. And, you know, I'm inspired by sort of corporate publishers, inspired that I don't want to be like them. You know what I mean? I hate that shit, you know, like selling out, you know, just to make money. And, you know, some of these books that they, you know, people jumping it at the, you know, one of the big five drop, Woody Allen, you have like these other publishers like lining up to publish it just to make money, or whatever else book just to make money. Like, I don't do that. I couldn't live with myself doing it. You know what I mean? This is like my life. You know what I mean? It's not just a job, and it's sort of like an outgrowth of me, and integrity is necessary.
So, Kyle, after you did the first batch, did you then put something out looking for authors? Did you approach authors? Like, what was the next process?
Yeah, it's interesting, you know, because we accept unsolicited submissions and stuff. But I think that, you know, my sort of, I don't know what you want to call it, my instincts as an editor, sensibility, I don't know. I've come up with a bunch of ideas or worked directly with my existing stable of writers. So most of the books this is when Andy and I were doing it. And I think most of the guys I have now, like, we recruited together. I have a tendency to work with the same people, right? Like Stradley did 5 books. Carlos has written 2, and we have 3 more in the pipeline with him. Todd Snyder, we did a couple books with. This new author, really good friend, great author. Bob Batchelor wrote the book about the Doors. He's writing a book about the Stones. And then he's writing a true crime book after that. So part of it sort of, you know, Paul Zannon with like the Tapia book, for example, like Pitch Me. I know that Chris Judice had the Macho Time book. So sometimes it's guys that I talk to about doing something that came to me. But I think the heart of it is kind of working with the same crew. You know, it's a team. I know like family's kind of cliche, but like, I think I kind of see it like that. You know, it's like a group of, kind of working with a lot of the same people.
Give us an example of a timeline. Like, you get the story or the idea and like the process from A to a finished book.
Yeah. Let's see. In the case of, like the last couple books, let's just go with those, like Boston Tabloid. Don Stradley, as I said, like lives in the next town, and we pre-pandemic, which was when the, you know, the genesis of that book, I think a little bit, happened or during early stages. I don't know. A lot of the books came to be at this like Portuguese restaurant. Like, it's like a, you know, 5-minute walk from my house, and like we would brainstorm, and like one of us brought up the idea of like this true crime case in Boston in the 80s. And it's, you know, I don't The interesting thing is, like, a lot of publishers make authors like jump through hoops and like write these long proposals that are, it's almost like writing the book itself. Like, I kind of don't operate that way because I think it's sort of twofold, right? I know a good idea if I, when I see one, typically, you know, I think, and if the idea is good and I know the author can write and they're cool, you know, in the case of Stradley, I'd already worked with him. Carlos, same thing. It's an easy decision to make. You know what I mean? I don't like making the other pieces. Like, I don't like making people jump through hoops. You know, oh, like, you know, take 3 months to do this proposal and you're killing yourself. And then I'm going to tell you now. You know what I mean? I don't like to do that to people. I think it's inconsiderate and I don't think it's necessary. And I've done, you know, going on 20 something books out, 30 total in terms of ones that are being written. Like, I've never once really had solicited a proposal, you know, like I've received a couple when I did the book, like coming out with a book, actually on Dropkick Murphy with a band named themselves after. Mm-hmm. Then a Boston Mob book that's coming out actually in May 23, and a Boston Mob book in the fall by the same author, her name's Emily Sweeney. And she had an agent, and those were proposals, but they're already done. You know, those are the first couple agented books that I have done. There's an agent / entertainment lawyer in Boston that I kind of work with, and he's the one agent that I kind of work with. But aside from that, it's like to answer the question, come up with the idea, come up with a time frame for writing, typically a year, and that's it, you know, and then production, and try to, you know, give myself as much time to publicize. You know, it's typically like 2 years.
And obviously without, you know, telling us a figure, like, I've never written a book before. How does that work? Do you pay them, they go away, and then when the book's published, kind of the revenue comes to you? How does that work?
Yeah, we pay in advance. You know, we're sort of like traditional publisher. You know, it's like advance, and then you know, the publisher pays for everything. Copy editing, typesetting, proofreading, design, all that stuff. And then there are sort of royalties on the back end, so that's how it works. You know, the interesting thing is that the economics of the book business kind of difficult. You know what I mean? Like, publisher of my size, like, you can't really risk a lot of money on an advance. You know, larger publishers do. Because they're $1 million, you know, multi-million, in some cases $1 billion companies. And like, their business model's kind of different, right? Like, some people call it like it's called like extreme publishing, right? All it is basically throwing money at like all kinds of book deals and relying on blockbusters to sort of be in the black, you know, like trying to remember which big five house put out like Michelle Obama, her book or something like that. Like, a book like that, because that's a thing. If you have a hit in publishing, whether it's me or anyone else, right, it's a license to print money, right? It's insane, you know what I mean? But it's not easy to get a hit, obviously, right? So, but the big publishers can just, you know, they can pay someone like Michelle Obama $5 million or whatever they paid her. And they're, you know, they know what they're doing. You know what I mean? I'm not, you know, I'm not a fan of corporate publishers, but they know what they're doing. And, you know, yeah, they, you know, and maybe they might get burned on one of those deals or something, but by and large, those blockbuster books plus, like, when I was at Houghton Mifflin Harcourt, they had, they, in the meantime, like, sold themselves to Hachette. It's the blockbuster books now and it's also the backlist, right? Like Houghton Mifflin had Tolkien, right? Like The Hobbit, right? They had Curious George, you know? So they can risk money right and left. And it's just a numbers game, you know what I mean? But I can't roll like that. I don't think I'd want to. It's just not, you know, for me, it's more like you have to be more conservative, you know.
How does it work when you write? So you have an upcoming book about someone, James Toney. How does that work? Do you have to approach him, pay him, just to get him to agree that you can write a book about him? What's the legal aspect around that?
Yeah. James was part of the deal. I'm trying to remember. It's been, you know, the book has taken a little while to write, 4 years, but the author kind of had some stuff going on, but he's back on track as far as I can tell. And, but yeah, James is in on that deal. He compensated, you know, it was sort of important, you know, that book. It's interesting too, right? Like, this is maybe a segue of sorts, you know, like I'm getting into true crime and music and film, you know, it's all basically pop culture, right? And, but I'm still going to do one or two boxing books a year or so, but, you know, because it's just my bread and butter, and I want to keep a foot in that world, right? So I can do your podcast like yours, because I, you know, I love boxing. It's a total passion, you know, for me. And but I, you know, I did like 20, you know, I've done like most of the subjects that I wanted to do. But man, that of all the books, I'd say, and that's not to kind of rank them or rank authors, like that's the one book that means the most to me, right? Because he's my favorite fighter. He's a great guy, and you know, spent time with him, and Andy and I went out to LA pre-pandemic and spent time with his sort of mentor, manager, surrogate father, Pops Arthur, who RIP. Passed away. Unfortunately, he's an amazing person with an amazing life story. And Pops is actually going to be, there's a lot of stuff about him in the book as well. So I can't wait for that book to be published. Very meaningful for me. And James was involved. It sort of had to be that way, you know.
They say, don't meet your heroes. How was it?
Yeah. it's funny, you know what I mean? Like, you know, if you can imagine, like, I started this business when I was 45, and it's been following boxing for years, and you know, it's a little trippy. I remember earlier, like Al Bernstein, like, wrote the foreword for the Off the Ropes, and I, you know, I talked to him on the phone. This was really early days, you know, and it kind of took me aback a little bit, you know, hearing him call fights since the 80s. But yeah, in the case of James, it was a definite trip. Like, we met him, we went out to LA and met him and Pops at Buddy McGirt's gym up in Northridge. Drove up there from staying at the Beverly Hilton, drove up to Northridge and went to Buddy McGirt's gym and met him, and yeah, it was a trip, you know what I mean? Ended up going to dinner that night, going out to a cigar bar with him, and yeah, it's definitely strange at first, hanging out with your favorite fighter for years, you know, but you kind of get used to it a little bit too, you know, and that applies to, you know, you do a lot of books, you start to, you know, rub shoulders maybe with high profile people, you know, friends with you know, like an author who's like a big time true crime author. Spent time, you know, visited him in Albuquerque. Like, you kind of get used to it a little bit, you know what I mean? But it's still trippy. I don't care what anyone says, you know.
It's quite fitting that you do boxing and now, you know, true crime, due to the fact, you know, boxing and the organized crime since, you know, well back in history.
Totally. Yeah, it's interesting too. It's like, I think, you know, like the list grew sort of organically. And I think, like, at first it was like, okay, well, maybe some of this was conscious, unconscious, but you know, when you publish books, it's like, you know, you want it to be multi-dimensional. You want it, you know, as much as possible. It's like, okay, well, Ron Lyle, like, went, you know, he was in jail. It's like a Hurricane Carter story. And then Jacob's Beach had the mob. And then, you know, Dark Trade's like very literary. It's not, you know, it's like literature. So it has that going for it. Then Bundini, sort of like an African-American life, you know, like Camacho's like, you know, Spanish Harlem was a character. Like, you always want to have different elements, right? But I think that over time, you know, we kind of realized, like, organically, like, what we were playing with these interchangeable elements. You know, the main one was boxing, but then true crime, organized crime, hip hop, some jazz, like Charles, you know, I'm a big jazz head, right? Charles Farrell's memoirs, like jazz, crime, boxing, right? I'm coming out with a book in June, Thug Life, true story of hip hop and organized crime. Seth Ferrante, who interestingly, started writing, he did a 21-year bid in federal prison. But, you know, you can see, like, or beatboxing was boxing and hip-hop, right? Thug Life, this book, is hip-hop and organized crime. You know, playing with those three elements a bit, you know, because they obviously intersect, right? Like, hip-hop and boxing definitely do. Like, look at Gervonta Tank Davis, right? Like, the hip-hop world shows up at his fights. You know what I mean? Those things dovetail. Boxing and crime dovetail.
Roy Jones Jr.?
Yeah, people like that stuff. You know what I mean? Sort of it's like the underworld, all of it. It's not underworld. It's like urban. Has to do with the underworld in some cases, you know, like, honestly, man, I don't know. I think boxing in a way is urban. MMA sort of maybe goes with, I don't know. Like, that's why I always gravitated towards boxing, just because, you know, I kind of like it and everything that the worlds that it we're in the same orbit, if you will.
Do you have a list of boxers or people in the fight world that you would like to do future books on?
It's a good question. I would never do a book about an active fighter, which is, I think, more of like a commercial play. You sort of see that in the UK, you know, especially when to my chagrin, I sort of look at the UK boxing book charts and Amazon, and it's, you know, Paris Fury is number one. There's like three Tyson Fury books, and, you know, like, you're asking for trouble anyway to do a book about an active fighter, because if they get knocked out, it just changes everything. You know what I mean? So you sort of need to see a trajectory that works in terms of storytelling. You know what I mean? So any other, that's a good question. No one I can think of. You know, Carlos in Sporting Blood, which is just, I'm very proud to have published that book, and it was our first full-length book, and I think that that book will sell probably even after I'm gone, right? My favorite essay in that, it's tough to pick, is the Aaron Pryor essay. And I don't know. It's hard because, you know, like the hard thing is that Pryor fought in the 80s and it's like the clock is ticking. But I just might like to do an Aaron Pryor book, The Hawk. You know what I mean? Hell of a fighter, crazy story, you know. That's that kind of subject sort of up my alley, but nothing else really comes to mind like right now.
I always thought, because there's no documentaries, there's no real interviews with him, Emmanuel Augustus, the Drunken Master.
Yeah, you know what? Shout out to my man Jimmy Tobin, who's we smaller crew writing for Hannibal Boxing now. Jimmy Tobin has written for Hannibal consistently, still does, and actually shout out to Raquel Vasquez, really talented freelance writer, who's going to start contributing. She contributes a column to Scott Legs McNeil, like a iconic punk rock journalist, has a website. She's been writing for his site, doing a really cool column called Bale Tales, and she's starting to contribute to Hannibal, just to kind of throw that out there on the state of Hannibal. But Jimmy actually wrote a piece about the Drunken Master. Wow. And I can't remember, I think maybe that he and I came up with it sort of like together. I don't know who thought of the Drunken Master. I think he did, but he did a series of, like, Darnell Boone too. Oh, yeah. Diesel, right? Like, we did, I think, those two pieces and maybe one other guy. That's a good call, Chet. You know, like, with Hamilcar Noir, I think I'm going to keep it at 7 just because I think it helps in terms of sales and marketing just to kind of make it finite. But I wouldn't mind, like, doing another series. Like, it's almost like Carlos Azevedo for Hannibal did a cool series of pieces called Brief Lives. And there are a lot of guys, like the Hamilcar Noir books are sort of like that too. So that's a really good idea, you know, and maybe like a book on Aaron Pryor. See, good man, you're giving me, you're going to do this more often. You're giving me book ideas.
Right.
Like I could do a series like Hamilcar Noir, but call it something else, but like the same length. You know what I mean? Because it's like 45,000 words. Someone can write it in 3 or 4 months. And I think I might like to do that, like Aaron Pryor, Emmanuel Augustus, like some of these guys who deserve a book, but maybe not one that's 200 pages that takes a year to write.
You know? Kind of like a bunch of like road warriors.
Exactly. Exactly. Yeah. Speaking of, I saw Glenn Johnson fight, by the way.
Yeah, he's another one. Yeah.
Chad Johnson, like, those kind of guys are very interesting, compelling fighters. Carson Jones, Jimmy did a piece on him. And it's amazing. Like, Darnell Boone, I think, maybe is arguably one of the most interesting guy in that respect, right? Like, he knocked down Andre Ward, like, gave Kovalev trouble. I'm trying to remember what the result of that. Like, he beat what, like, a name, you know. Those guys are so much better than they get credit for, and can, you know, really take world-class fighters to hell on a given night.
Kevin Kingpin Johnson,
right? If they have a proper training camp, you know, don't take a fight on like a week's notice, or, you know. I think that's a fascinating phenomenon in terms of boxing, if you ask me, you know, especially in these days of you know, people guarding goose eggs like it's a golden egg, you know, or however you want to say it.
But Kyle, just tell us what's next for Hamilcar Publications. We kind of touched on it just then, but what is the what's the next plan over the next 2-3 years?
I'm pretty excited, man. Sort of just to go sequentially, May, Dropkick Murphy book, written by Emily Sweeney, is a Boston Globe reporter. It's about Dropkick Murphy was like a pro wrestler and owned and operated like a sanitarium, which alternately called a health farm, sometimes pejoratively called a quote unquote drunk farm, where alcoholics, it was like sort of like a primitive treatment facility for people with problems with drinking. The band named themselves after Dropkick Murphy, sort of like a local Boston legend. Ken Casey of the Dropkick Murphys, who I think you know is also a boxing promoter, just put on a card right around St. Paddy's Day, actually. He wrote the foreword. And I'm kind of excited, you know, like the thing in publishing is to do like regional publishing, right? So I'm a Boston publisher. So, you know, I did Boston Tabloid, did Hagler, Hearns. So I try to, you know, keep it local in some cases. And Thug Life, which I mentioned, that's June. And then the fall, Carlos Acevedo is coming out party as a, you know, literary nonfiction author. I put Carlos against anyone. Huge talent. He's writing a book called The Devil Inside about the making of The Exorcist, which I'm really psyched about. Sort of like a Hollywood book. A book on the Stones called Dirty Stones about the Stones in the 70s. Jet setting, sex, drugs. You know, it's like, you know, we're making this really sex, drugs, rock and roll book, even more so than the Doors book. In the spring, a book called American Hellfire. Carlos is writing that as well, about Satanism and true crime, Satanism, the satanic panic, the, you know, lyrics in the 80s, but also like the Night Stalker and all these Sons of Sam, right? I think that's going to be a hell of a book. My distributor's like totally pumped about that one too. And then just to jump back in the fall, Four on the Floor, it's called The Story of Bobby Luisi and Boston's Last Mob War by Emily, who's writing the Dropkick Murphy book. That's a Boston gangster book. Four on the Floor is a reference to something called the 99 Restaurant Massacre, which happened like 94, 95. A father and son, basically, who were both kind of connected to the underworld. The father was like a Vietnam vet, was just like a very hardcore guy. Father and son basically, shot dead four gangsters in a restaurant just outside of Boston. So the book is about that. And the gangster in question, Bobby Luisi, his father was actually shot in the massacre. And they were sort of in opposing crews, right? So it's sort of like this, I don't know, Shakespearean, biblical kind of story, whatever you want to call it. But, you know, it's kind of murky, like maybe the son let it happen. You know what I mean? So it's kind of a twisted tale, but it's also like the fall of the mob in the 90s in Boston, like after Whitey Bulger took off, right? So so that's, you know, those are some of the titles that we have coming up. Pretty excited about it.
One question, Kyle, that I always like to finish on is, what advice would you give someone that wants to follow in your footsteps and they're, you know, sick of working a 9-to-5 and they have some type of dream that they want to follow?
Just don't give up. You know, my mother told me sort of meant a great deal. Like once we sort of started, she said, you never gave up. That meant that meant a lot, you know. And I know that it's trite, but you just got to keep pressing, you know. If I think about all the different business ideas that I had, you know, just keep, don't give up, and just keep pressing, and do your own thing, because it's incredibly gratifying, like the feeling of freedom that you have when you escape the 9-to-5 world is hard to sort of, it feels like you're in jail. You know what I mean? One of my authors actually was in jail. You know what I mean? So I don't want to sort of, I don't know. I don't feel quite comfortable making that comparison, but it almost feels like that. Now, that is not to put anyone down who does a 9-to-5, but like, just go for it, you know, and try to, you know, it's worth it. If you can free yourself from all that stuff.
Well, Carlos, I want to thank you for joining me today. And if you want to tell everyone where they can find you on social media, the website, where they can buy your books.
Yep, hamilcarpubs.com. Everything's there in terms of, you know, upcoming and what we have out. And then we have the journalism site, hannibalboxing.com, which sort of reflects the book list now. It's just Hannibal. In terms of the title of the site, and boxing, true crime, hip hop, and more. So kind of widen the umbrella with that, and you know, doing some book excerpts. And as I said, Raquel is contributing as well. Obviously there's some boxing in her stuff, but you know, sort of like a crime angle too, in terms of her exposure to the underworld, as she's a bail agent in LA, so it sort of fits, you know, sort of fits the, you know, the Hannibal kind of reflects the where the direction that the book publishing list is taken organically.
We are at TLRMMA on Twitter and Instagram, and join us next time. This is The Last Round.
Thanks for listening to this episode of the Last Round MMA podcast. Make sure you subscribe so you don't miss any future episodes and interviews. In the meantime, follow the Last Round MMA on Twitter and Instagram at TLRMMA.